Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey. So reading the actual Exodus, if you've been following already the progression of texts, we've been dealing with the story of Moses and Egypt, the plagues, and now it's finally the point in the story where they're leaving. They're starting this big journey together. And so it's the beginning of Moses' ministry. And what I would like to do, there's so many nice things you could follow in these stories, but I want to look at a broad scope, especially three stories together, and by comparing them, seeing what interpretation we can get that you wouldn't get if you just read it by itself. And I want to specifically focus on the character of Moses, how he is leading the people, how he's interacting with the people of God, and how I think he will mature through this section of the Torah, these three or four chapters. Okay, so it's important to point out when we come to Bible stories, when we have a certain Bible character, how do we get to know the character? How do we know something about them? Because the story, you look confused. What do you mean, how do we know? The Bible tells us. Well, how does it tell us? It doesn't always say things in words. Like, it doesn't say, he was a mean, old, grumpy man. Instead, it shows you, tells you a story about something mean and grumpy that person did. Now, the Hebrew Bible likes to be very condensed. It's a dense story. There's few words, and there's few descriptions. And so we understand somebody's character by what they do. Every once in a while, we get some quotes, what they say. And oftentimes, you know, the first things they say and do are very significant to who that character is. And so it benefits us not only to look individually at stories and dig deeply in each word, but then also to step back and look at several stories together so that you can see how the same character is acting in several different stories. And that will actually develop who that character is. And that's what we will try to do this morning. So for Moses, if we're looking at his life, of course we would start back in the beginning, which hopefully some of you have been doing in recent weeks. If not, you can, after this, go back and refresh yourself with chapter 3 and 4, where Moses is first called to ministry. If we need to, we can refer backwards. But this is where he's starting his role as leading the people. Okay. So the first story we want to look at is crossing the Red Sea. The parasha portion starts at the end of chapter 13. And it wasn't Pharaoh sending out of the people. You know, God didn't let them go up by way of the land of the Philistine, up by the coast, because that was the short route. They said, you know, maybe the people will chicken out. They'll see war and be afraid and want to go back to Egypt. So he takes them instead the desert route by Yam Suf, whichever Yam you want to call Yam Suf. We won't get into that. Okay. So starting in Exodus chapter 14, let's look at the opening verses there. And you can look, how many languages of translations do we have here this morning?
Many.
Many.
Yes.
Good. We have some French.
English and French.
Yes, yes.
Some English. Any German?
Dutch.
Dutch.
Finnish over there.
Finnish? Good. So then we'll have some good interaction on what words are what. Okay. So I will, well, does somebody want to read the first four verses?
The first four verses.
First four verses, yes.
In French or can I be French?
How many speak French here? That would benefit about eight of us. Maybe English is better.
Yes,
okay.
Anyone with English?
34. Is it chapter
34? No, chapter 14. The first four verses.
I'll read it then.
Okay.
New Living.
All right.
Then the Lord gave these instructions to Moses. Tell the people to march towards Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdal and the sea camp, there along the shore, opposite Baal Zephon. Then Pharaoh will think, those Israelites are confused. They are trapped between the wilderness and the sea. Once again I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. I have planned this, so I will receive great glory at the expense of Pharaoh and his army. After this, the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord.
Wow. Once again I will harden. That's nice. Okay. So what has God told Moses here?
You're going to do it in such a way that God will gain all the glory for himself.
Okay, God's going to gain glory. Do we know what's going to happen? What are the people actually commanded to do?
Become cornered.
Basically, their instructions are go camp by the sea. That's all they know, right? So they've been given a layout of a plan by God, but it's a very rough sketch of what God's actually going to do. They don't know. All they know is they're supposed to go camp by a sea and that God is going to be honored.
Well, Moses has been told by God that the point of that is to draw out Pharaoh, to see them in a weakened position.
Yes. Okay. When God is talking to Moses, he's saying, when you camp by the sea, Pharaoh is going to think that you're confused, and so he's going to come out and chase you. And he says, and I will make his heart hard. He doesn't actually say again, but we know from the plagues that he's already done this. There's been, if you follow through the plagues, you can just follow the words for hard. There's a rhythm. They'll keep repeating themselves. Pharaoh makes his own heart is heavy, and then he hardens his heart. God hardens his heart. There's many different interplays back and forth. Here it's using the word hazak, to be very strong. Heart. God is making his heart hard, and he's going to chase after him, and says, and I will be, either I will be honored by Pharaoh, or with Pharaoh, or I will be heavy on Pharaoh. Nichbad. Nichbad is to be honored. It's also to be heavy, depending on your context. And be, to be heavy in or on something, or to be honored through them. Usually, if you're talking about being honored, you would think, I will be honored more than Pharaoh, right? Because God is showing himself to be greater than Pharaoh. But we don't have that preposition here. Instead, I will be honored in Pharaoh, or on Pharaoh. And
sorry, wouldn't we be looking at the plagues before and the consistency about that in relation to this, and also the fact that the plagues were against the gods of Egypt, and Pharaoh is considered a god, so God is elevating himself above Pharaoh?
Definitely. I would say that there are some, it's part of a continuing narrative. Each little story has its own point, but it's also fitting into a bigger picture. And I want to point out linguistically how there are some plays going on with the words. And so one of them relates to this word for heavy. because there's a lot of ironic shifts. There's heaviness and there's honor, and they are connected.
Mm-hmm.
There's heaviness. When God is heavy on someone, that you could almost see it as a funny picture in your mind, a big, heavy cloud of glory resting on Pharaoh. You could also say God is going to be honored more than Pharaoh. But it doesn't use the word more than, it just uses on him. So it's kind of like this ambiguous, it's clear and yet it has two meanings at the same time.
And then both can be considered Greek as well then?
Greek?
No, both can be considered Greek if there's two meanings.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be either or, it can be...
Right. In Hebrew it doesn't have to be either or. The minute we take it to French or to English or Dutch, now we have to choose one or the other. Again, the word I'm talking about in the text, Ikavda befaro, I will be honored or I will be heavy on Pharaoh. And both those meanings are used throughout the plague stories, and we'll see further on as well. If you remember, though some of you have background in Hebrew, some maybe don't, kaved is the word for heavy, kavod is the word for glory. So you can hear with your ears that those are similar, and they're coming from a similar base root. So they can be played with. When you're trying to tell a message, you can make your point more powerful by using the words themselves playfully. Okay, so God is going to be honored, and he's going to be heavy on Pharaoh, all his army, and they... And Egypt will know that I am God. And says, and they did it. So what did the people do at the end of verse 4?
Camp.
They camped.
Next to the sea.
They obeyed God. So they just got their first directive. We're going to go camp by the sea. We don't know what's going to happen, but God's going to do something to be honored in Pharaoh, or to be heavy on him. So then the following verses we have is told to the king of Egypt that the people fled. That's very interesting, because we know they were released. And his heart changed. It turned over. And all his servants and his people. And they said, what have we done? Why did we send away Israel from serving us? So they tied up their chariots and their army or their people. Am can be the people that follow you into battle or just people. And Pharaoh took them with him. And he took 600 good chariots, and let's skip down a bit. Okay, so verse 8, it's only half a verse later. God hardens Pharaoh's heart like he said he would, and Pharaoh chases after Israel. And now we're getting a picture, it's kind of like a representation. The story starts referring to Israel as one character and Egypt as another character. So you could almost put this dramatically quite easily. And it mentions Israel, by the way, Israel is going out with an uplifted hand. What do you have? This is a little bit of an aside, but I'm interested to know verse 8, how what translations we have for that.
In mine, which is a Jewish translation, defiantly.
Defiantly. Okay.
And the TEV has triumphantly.
Triumphantly.
Mm.
Boldly. Okay.
Et en français?
Librement.
What in French?
Qu'est-ce que vous avez en français?
Librement.
Librement.
Librement. Freely.
Freely.
Freely. Librement. Anything else? What else?
Victoriously.
Victoriously. Mm-hmm. We're asking for verse 8. Mm-hmm. Chapter 14 of Exodus, verse 8. Boldly. Okay. That's a great thing about metaphors. Sometimes they're not as clear as you think they are. Or again, they could have two meanings. So when your hand is uplifted, what does that mean? And I think if you put all these words we've heard together, you can get an abstract picture usually you could be referring to war, somebody with an uplifted hand, or victory. It's maybe a symbol of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And boldly, in the sense that they're not hiding. And so why is this important? Because they were slaves in Egypt. They're not running away in secret. So our narrator is telling us, no, it was boldly. Now, if you remember, right before, if you look back in chapter 13.
Could I offer one thing?
Yes, please.
Hey, y'all, follow me.
Follow me. That the Israelites want them to follow?
You be on to me. Talk to
us. That's right. The tour guide with the umbrella or the hat.
Or the flowers.
They're straight. A hand can also be, especially when you're referring to one hand, it can be a symbol of strength, right? In many, this goes across many languages, especially uplifted. You know, that's a very strong symbol. You're not doing this, holding your hand low. If you remember back in verse 18 of chapter 13, it says that when Israel left Egypt, they were what?
Like a marching army.
Like a marching army. Hamushim. They were decked out for war. They were armored.
Armed for battle.
Armed for battle. Okay. This would be interesting to see everybody go out armed for battle. So this could also be some of your translations that talk about defiantly or valiantly. You think of more battle imagery. An uplifted hand maybe is referring to the fact that they're ready to fight, even though, ironically, God doesn't want them to face war lest they chicken out. And chicken out, I mean, become cowards and run away. Okay, so we have Yad Rama, generally accepted to mean bold. Hey, you want to sit here? So they come out boldly. They're not hiding. They're not just escaping slaves. And Egypt chases them. And all Pharaoh's chariotry and his charioteers and all his army and strength, they come out to Pi-Hahiroth in Baal-Zephon. So let's move on to verse 10. Israel lifts his eyes up, and here is Egypt riding out after them, and they fear greatly, and the children of Israel call out to God. Okay, so we have a whole nation crying out to God, and then they say something to Moses. So let's listen to what they say. They say, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us to die in the desert? What is this that you have done to us to bring us out of Egypt? Isn't this the thing that we said to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone and let us serve Egypt, because it's better for us to serve Egypt than to die in the desert?" So who are they saying brought them to the desert, or brought them out of Egypt?
Moses.
They're clearly putting the blame on Moses.
Although but it says they cried out to the
it
Lord.
It does say they cried out to God. So first they cry out to God, and then they blame Moses.
Mm-hmm.
That if you've ever had a position of leadership, you can sympathize with Moses here. They tend to get the blame for a lot of things. And so here we have Moses' first answer to the people. This is like their first crisis of the Exodus. And the first answer is verse 13 and 14. So Moses says to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand up," or like secure yourself, "and see the salvation of the Lord that he will do for you today. Because the way you see Egypt today, you won't see again, ever. God will fight for you and you will be still." All right. What do you think of Moses' words?
Uh,
Are they, like, do you sense a strong leader, a weak leader? Is he worried? Is he confident? Is he faithful?
Seems very confident.
Seems very confident, right?
Hmm.
You just stand where you are and watch. God's going to fight for you. But then, look at verse 15. And God said to Moses, "Why do you scream out to me? Speak to the people and let them go forward."
This is not chronological.
Yeah. Well, one thing about this story, maybe several people recorded it, and then at some point both storytellings were brought together. We don't know. Maybe one person recorded it, and another person wanted to point out certain features, kind of add some focus here and there. And so we seem to have kind of, it could be that we have several different narratives put together. But that's, it doesn't really matter, because in the end, this is the text God gave us, and the composite is the beautiful full picture. That said, any story has detail and leaves some detail out. And in this case, we know that Moses cried out to God, not because it told us, but it tells us by God's answer. Why are you crying out to me? It never told us that Moses cried out for whatever stylistic reason, but now it's saying, why are you crying out to me? So we know Moses actually did cry out to God. That means he wasn't quite sure what was going on. We don't know if the words he just said, "Stand and see God deliver you," if that's a quote from what God told him, or if that's what he came up with, or if that's someone helping us understand the whole picture with the benefit of hindsight.
Or it could be that God was speaking to Moses as a representative of the people.
Exactly.
Of the people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he certainly has and will do that. Moses is a representative of the people. Who else is he a representative of? God himself. Mm-hmm. Moses is a very unique character. I don't think there's anyone else in the Bible in his role, if you follow out his whole story. Okay. So in verse 16, it says, "And you..." He says, "You lift up your rod and stretch out your hand on the water or on the sea and split it." How would you feel if God asked you to split water right now? It seems wild and daring on God's part. And he says, "And then the people of Israel will go through on dry land." And so, verse 17, what's God's part? If Moses is supposed to lift up his hand and split the water, what is God going to do? Harden Egypt's heart, and then what? So that they chase them.
Yeah.
Okay, who has a harder job here?
The Israelites.
Israelites to walk through on dry land?
No, to believe.
To believe? Okay. Maybe that's all our hard job to do. But God is saying he's splitting up tasks. Okay, Moses, you go part the water. I'm going to chase the people in. Which task would you rather do? I would rather chase the people in the water. I don't know how to part the water. And I think the story, the structure of the sentences here are clearly, look at the first word, well, I don't know, it's clear in Hebrew, it might be clear in your translation too. If you compare verse 16 and 17, it's clearly set up as a two-person plan. You do this, and I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. Moses and God are cooperating. And I'm not saying God isn't the one who parts the water in the end, but I'm saying God on purpose is actually expecting a very high thing from the person he has set up as his representative. And it's being told as if they are partners in this. Moses is very active, and he's supposed to come up with something. Yes. Sorry, I'm busy right now. So that's our first picture of Moses as this leader partnering with God. And it seems crazy what God is asking out of him, if you really think about it. And at the end of verse 17, again the goal is stated that we heard in verse 4. What is it? God is going to chase Egypt into the sea. Why?
Gain glory.
To gain glory. This thing again. And I will be honored, or I will be heavy on Pharaoh. And on all his army, or all his strength. On his chariots and on his charioteers. And, in verse 18, continues, and Egypt will know that I am God. In my being heavy on Pharaoh, or my being honored in Pharaoh and in his chariots and on his charioteers. This threefold repetition we keep getting. Now, Egypt is going to know that God is God. That's a little strange because in the plagues, what were the plagues about? The plagues get progressively worse. And what does God keep saying is the point of all of this? To know that God is God. So Egypt will know that he's God. So, you've already proven you're God. But here we are again. They're going to know on a new level. Or in a new situation.
Is it that they will go in depth? Or is it that there are other Egyptians who will hear about it?
Maybe both. And this gets back to the way the story is being told to us. It's saying all Egypt is there, but clearly all Egypt isn't there, because someone's back in Egypt hearing about the story later. And we know from history, Egypt as a nation still existed.
But it doesn't seem to have worked. The Egyptians may have seen that and recognized that as God, but it didn't change them.
Well, maybe it changed some of them.
I think also that they knew that God is God, but this doesn't affect their life.
Right.
Yes.
There's levels of knowing that God is God. Mm-hmm. And also the ones who don't make it, they're going to know God is God. Yeah. That's for certain.
What's that song we sing that... Every knee will bow, but
and
to those who choose earlier, it's better.
Oh, right.
Do you remember
that? I know that song. One day, every tongue will confess you are Lord. One day, every knee will bow. But the greater treasure remains for those who gladly serve you now.
I think it's also good to think about the Israelites, because they say, it's better to have died in Egypt. So
exactly,
they stand still and what they will never see them again. So that was a really clear picture of how you will never see them again. It's
right. Right.
It's a confirmation to the Israelites that he will see your salvation.
So even though that isn't stated as a purpose in this verse, certainly we'll see by the end of the story, one of the bigger purposes of the crossing of the sea is really for Israel's faith. God can prove himself to Egypt, and that's good. But when he proves that he's greater than Egypt, that ultimately the effect is that Israel is going to believe.
And isn't there a further one with God underlining his covenant with Abraham, I'll bless those that bless you and curse those that curse you. others in history afterwards can look back and see the covenant being kept.
Sure. It's again, it can line up with all God's promises that people in history afterwards can look back and see he has kept. Okay. So then we get a little section on the angel of God separating the camp so they don't go to each other during the night. And then we actually have Moses, in verse 21, Moses stretches his hand out over the sea. And then God does take the sea back with a strong easterly wind all night long. And he makes the sea dry. And the sea splits. So even though God asked Moses to do it, obviously God helps him out. Moses did have to stretch out his hand, but since he'd done a few plagues, he might have figured that was worth a try. And he has the command from God, stretch out your staff in your hand. And you notice when in verse 21, it says Moses stretched out his hand. It doesn't mention his staff anymore. This is also very characteristic if you read through the stories. Sometimes only the staff is mentioned, sometimes only his hand, and sometimes Aaron's staff is mentioned. And when you're looking at all the stories together, it's significant because the person being inspired to write this story down for us wants to make it clear that there's nothing special in that staff. That can do, it's not a magic stick. And so it can come in or out of the story, and it really doesn't matter because a miracle is going to happen through God. And so it's another, when you see this flipping back and forth, that's on purpose. And if we were to look back at Moses' starting story in chapter 3 and 4, God says, I will place these signs in your hand, which can also mean in your authority. So we know Moses has been commissioned by God, and you could take it literally, to use his hand to do God's signs. And then the following verses, so take your staff, the one that he used, he did many signs through Moses' staff. So since the beginning of Moses' call to ministry, we have this blend between Moses' hand and his staff. And they're both legitimate ways that God will use him. So I'm in verse 22. The people go through the land, go through the water on dry land, go through the sea on dry land, and the water is their wall on the right and left. And Egypt chases after them, and they came after them, all of Pharaoh's horses and chariots and charioteers into the sea. And it was in the first gleams of the morning, God looked at them on the camp of Egypt. And where does he look at them from? It's written right there in verse 24.
From the pillar of fire and cloud.
Pillar of fire and cloud. That's the same one that has already been with them and has been dividing the camps. And what does that do to them?
Went in a panic.
Sends them into a panic. We don't know what kind of zap, what kind of craziness went on. We just see the effect. It sends them into a panic. And this is the same kind of panic God sends in other wars in the future that basically results in Israel's victory. But then look at verse 25. What happens to the chariots? What does he do to the chariots? Why do the wheels fall off?
In my translation, it said that he locked the wheels.
He locked the wheels. Okay.
And mine says cloud. Sort of the idea of them sinking into the mud, sort of cloud.
Clogged. Okay.
Which verse?
You made the verse 25.
Except that if they walk on dry land, then how could it be mud for the Egyptians? Unless
it's another miracle.
Yeah.
Interesting little question, because they're chasing after the Israelites. So Israelites are on dry land. And now Egypt is having real problems with their chariots. So if you had to portray this in a movie, you could be creative and start showing like the hard land and then like stinking sand, you know, creeping right behind them. If the Prince of Egypt. Once you start thinking about these stories and try to put them, how would I actually portray this in a movie, you come up with questions you'd never thought about before, such as this one.
There's some clarity in the last part of the verse because the Egyptians understand the problem. They understand that it's from God.
Uh-huh. And how do they drive those chariots? What does it say? They drive them? In heaviness. Does anyone have any form of heavy in your translation? English, French, Dutch? No?
I don't have Dutch, I have Hebrew.
Okay, it's a shame because this whole play we've been talking about, God's glory and heaviness, being heavy on someone brings, it's God showing off when he's heavy on somebody. Here, they're driving, it says literally, in heaviness. So God has told us he's going to be heavy on Pharaoh. He's going to be honored through Pharaoh with the same that same word. And here is the word. So in the picture of God proving himself to them, it's using this heaviness. And you could say, here we're seeing the practical side of the word. How is God getting glory? He is literally weighing down on them. He's squishing their chariots into the mud, so that they can't move forward. The wheels will not turn. Or the wheels get stuck, you could say. Clogged. Maybe in the mud, as another miracle. Maybe just God's heaviness. I don't know how you would depict that. A heavy cloud or a heavy goo coming up, stopping those wheels.
It gives me a bit of a picture. Going through difficult circumstances for those that are in the Lord can walk through them. Mm-hmm. And those that don't have the Lord, it's heavy.
Yeah.
Heavy burden. And they get clogged or the despair. And
that's right. And so their response is twofold. I need to run away from Israel. And God is fighting for Israel against Egypt. So we see the physical heaviness of God on them, and through that, he is getting the glory because they are saying, hey, this is God fighting us, it's not just them.
Could we not look at the Elisha servant situation where the blindness is taken away and you see the God's army? Is it, could not be angels involved in this?
Oh, sure. You could do all kinds of things.
You can get quite creative in how God is doing this about.
Yeah, because actually when you try to look at the nuts and bolts of miracles, it becomes very vague. Mm-hmm. Like, God makes them panicky. Well, what does that mean? What actually happened? I don't know. Did God send out lasers? You know, did he look them in the eye? It doesn't give us those kind of details. But there is this weight of glory that's being dumped on Egypt and is sinking them in. Okay, so then let's move on because we're getting close to end of time. Verse 26, God says to Moses, stretch out your hand over the water and it'll go back over Egypt and all his chariots and all his charioteers. So Moses does that. He stretches out his hand over the sea and it goes back at the turning of morning to its full strength. All right, so this has all happened at dawn. So maybe God used the sunlight as well to flash in their eyes at the right time. Who knows? And so now it's describing Egypt as running towards, it says Egypt is fleeing towards him, towards Israel. So we know God has confused them earlier, and we know that they're trying to run away from Israel, but what's happening here? Where are they running? They're running towards Israel. Why are they running backwards out of the sea? I don't know, maybe God closed the one side first, or maybe they are confused. They have lost their direction, the sunlight in their eyes blinded them. You could fill in many details here. In either case, they're running the wrong direction, and so they get swept up and God shakes them in the sea. What do you have for Vayena Er? He shakes them in verse 27.
Hurled the Egyptians into the sea?
Hurled, okay. Yeah, he swept them up, he shook them around in the water. They get swallowed up in the water. The water comes back and it covers over all of them, everyone who would come after them. And verse 29, you could say, but the children of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, and the water had been a wall for them on the right and the left. And God saved on that day, he saved Israel from the hand of Egypt, and Israel saw Egypt lying dead on the shore. Okay, now this is the key verse. Verse 31. Israel saw the great hand that God did in Egypt, and they feared. The people feared God, and they believed in God and in Moses, his servant. That's a powerful little verse. What did Israel see? The power of the Lord. Okay. Someone's just helped us out with this metaphor. It literally says they saw the great hand that God did. So we know hand can be a metaphor for many things. So it's suggestive of power. When we talk about the hand of the Lord, it could also remind us of the plague. God's hand can bring miraculous plagues, signs, wonders, and it's all summed up in his hand. So they see this great hand that God did. So God did a hand. So that's, we know it's metaphoric language. He didn't see a physical hand up there because it's something he did.
And it's a phrase in both languages.
In both meaning?
Hebrew and English.
Yeah. Well, depending how you translate it, you could smooth it out.
Right.
If you just say, the people saw God's great power, then you would never know that there was this funny little metaphor. And what is the result of seeing this great hand?
They stood in awe of the Lord.
They stood in awe of the Lord. And what else?
And they had faith in the Lord and in his servant Moses.
Right. How does this strike you? Is everyone comfortable with that? Do you all believe in Moses?
Probably both did it.
Task division. Yeah, you're right. But most people, especially Christians, they don't want to say they believe in Moses.
But they trusted him. Because they will not. It's faith and trust.
It's faith.
Confidence.
Whatever, my point here is it's the same word. Whatever they're doing to God, they're doing to Moses too.
Yeah.
So whether you want them to say trusting or believing, mm-hmm. It's a powerful statement.
That's what God had told the people. Told Moses earlier, he said, "You will be like God."
You'll be like God, exactly. And that's why I mentioned earlier that Moses is a very unique person. I don't think there's anyone else in the Bible you can point to that represents God like Moses. And that's why it was also so important that people didn't make him God. So in all these stories, you have his involvement that we've pointed out, how he seems to be working with God as a partner, and yet in the end he always has to kind of be demoted and put in his place, like, by the way, Moses is just a person.
I like the French translation here. In French they say le peuple craignit l'Éternel. That means he has a kind of a fear of God, mm-hmm. and il crut en l'Éternel et en Moïse. It's not the same word. And
right.
to croire en quelqu'un, someone can. if you use the verb croire, that means to trust someone, rely on. My English is not so good, but I'm just trying to rely on him, and I think it's different. That's the.
Well, there are two words. Mm-hmm. The people do fear God, and that's something they only fear God. They don't fear Moses.
Mm-hmm.
But the following word, they believed, whether you want to say they trusted or they believed, mm-hmm. they did it in God and in Moses.
Okay, I don't have the
those
English
two
word,
yeah. are the parallel. I'm not talking about the English, I'm talking about the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
It says, Vaya'aminu ba'adonai uve'moshe avdo. So you have one verb that is being applied to God and to Moses.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this set up. We're going to skip the Song of the Sea. It's beautiful poetry. It stands on its own. And I think we're actually going to skip the next story.
May I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
We have some relatives that are Orthodox Jews, and they keep saying that all these miraculous things happen when God parted the water, and that all the trees started to grow, and all kinds of different foods started to grow. Mm-hmm. What do you know about this?
Well, as I said, the Bible leaves a lot out of the details of miracles. And so there's always room to be imaginative and to put in interpretation. As long as it's an interpretation that brings you back to looking at the text itself, it can be good. Some interpretations go a little far out and make you chuckle a bit, mm-hmm. as opposed to something you really think like, oh yeah, that's probably what happened. But in either case, if you're going back to what's written, that's a good thing. That's the base. Okay, we're going to go through chapter 17 really fast, just to tie into some of the themes that we've already been looking at. Specifically, Moses' role, right? We've had a couple stories in between. We've had one water that was bitter that God directed Moses and made it sweet, drinkable. And then we had the man and quail. Now, we're in chapter 17. And the people are traveling in Midbar Sin, the Sin wilderness, according to God. And they camp at Refidim, and there's no water to drink. Okay, verse 2. They quarrel with Moses, and they say, give us water and let us drink. And Moses says to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test God? So what's Moses saying in his answer?
To question him is to question God.
Yeah.
I guess it do.
That's pretty powerful. I don't think... We can't really relate to this because I don't know... Well, maybe if you were Catholic, you could relate to this more. To question the Pope is to question God. It's this kind of authority we're talking about that is kind of... in my mind, dangerous. definitely not Protestant. But again, Moses has been uniquely assigned to represent God. And so in a sense, you could see that Moses has the right attitude here. Like he's been put in this position to be God, be God's mouthpiece to the people. So he's saying, not only is it bad that you're complaining, but by complaining against what I'm saying, you're not really complaining against me, you're just complaining against God. And you're testing God. Okay, so the people are thirsty there, and they complain against Moses. Now it's using a different word for complaining. Instead of quarreling, they're complaining. And they say, why did you take us out of Egypt? So again, they're blaming Moses. To kill me and my children and my cattle with thirst. So what does Moses do in verse 4?
He prays earnestly to the Lord.
He prays earnestly. That sounds really nice.
He cried out to the Lord.
He cried out. He went, ah! It's the same zoek. It's to yell out. We remember at the sea, God says, why are you crying out to me? Why are you yelling at me? You do something. Lift up your hand and part the water then. And we were kind of shocked at God's expectations of Moses back on the sea. Here, Moses is, we didn't even get Moses' cry back there. Here it's written down for us. He cried out for God, to God, and it's actually quoted what he said. What did he say to God? Another moment and they're going to stone me. So he's clearly distressed. He's not so confident. He's not telling them to stand and see God's deliverance. So, God comes up with a plan in verse 5 and 6. God says to Moses, go on ahead of the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and your staff that you struck the Nile with. Take in your hand and go. Okay, Moses obviously knows he struck the Nile with a staff. Why does God mention that? Moses has done a lot of things with his staff.
It's a reminder.
A reminder. And what does it remind us of?
God's power.
God's power? Displayed where or in what instance?
The Nile flood opening the Red Sea.
Well, when Moses struck with his staff on the Nile, what happened?
Did it change into blood?
It changed into blood. It became undrinkable, that's right. So it's the opposite of what's going to happen here. So this is a nice little reminder. Like, hey, do you remember that I've already dealt with the opposite problem? If I could do that, you don't think I can flip it and do the opposite? It's kind of like a little reminder, all in just a few words, by referring to the staff as the staff you struck the Nile with. We need to jump back to that story. So in verse 6, he says, here I am. I'm going to be standing there before you on the rock at Horeb. Where is that? Horeb. What's the name? Horeb. What's another name?
Sinai.
This is the mountain of God. It has two names, Mount Horeb. So there's a rock somewhere there on the mountain of God. He says, God says to Moses, look, I'm going to be standing up there before you. You strike that rock and water will come out. And the people will drink. So Moses did that before the elders of Israel. It's interesting. Do you catch the same structure in verse 6? You have God telling, okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to do. We're doing this miracle together. I'm going to be standing there on the rock, and you're the one that's going to strike it, and then the water's going to come out. So that place gets called Massah, which means testing, and Merivah, arguing. Because the people argued and they tested God. So again, verse 7 goes back to this theme of when you test Moses, you're really ultimately testing God. And they say, how did the people test God? What was their question? Is God really here? Is he really able to produce water? If you've been to previous sermons and Bible studies, you'll remember the interpretation in the gap between these two stories. The people just test God and they have doubt, and then their first war encounter comes. And you can read between the lines that it's kind of a punishment for their doubt. Then comes Amalek and fights with them at Rephidim. Yeah. Okay, we don't have time to read the next story, but let me just summarize what I think I have learned and hopefully you've all gleaned something. The next story is very curious because Moses does a bunch of stuff with only his hand. It's when the Amalekites attack. He lifts his hand, lowers his hand. It never mentions him crying out to God. It mentions the rod at first in his hand, but then when he lifts and lowers, it talks about hands and no rod. These all these curious questions. And if you were just reading that story in Exodus, you would come away with an idea that maybe Moses is, I don't know, what is he doing? He's maybe doing something magical. But when we've been reading it in this context, the fact that he doesn't pray could actually be taken as a positive thing. Because we had in the sea, what did God say to Moses? Why are you crying out to me? The implication, I've set you up, you try to do something. Try to solve this problem. And of course, God always does this partnership with him. Then when it comes to Amalek, finally Moses doesn't cry out to God, he simply does something. And he tells Joshua, okay, you do this and I'll do that. So now instead of this partnership with God and Moses, or the description, we have that same partnership with Moses and Joshua. So it's like Moses has finally stepped into his God-appointed role of being representative of God. And then his action, whatever crazy thing he was doing, is proving God's presence, because that's who Moses is. But we only get that when we read it in the context of all these stories together, how God has been working with Moses to try to make him take initiative and represent him to the people. If we had more time, we could go on to the balance of that, as we mentioned in the beginning. If you revere Moses too highly, you might think that he has special powers in and of himself, that he is able to do magic, or he's somehow half God. And that's why you have to point out his weaknesses. And you see in this story, his hands are heavy. So now, instead of, you know, now Moses is the heavy person, not just Egypt, and that's showing that it's God's glory. When other people are heavy, God gets the glory. So that same verbal link. The following story, he's also trying to do a task that's too heavy for him. So you have that heaviness of Moses that's balancing with our picture of him being the representative of God's power and his glory. And you get that when you start looking at the details compared to each other from all these stories together. If you just read one story by itself, you would lose some of that interpretation. So our time is up. Is there any final comments someone wants to say?
It's a beautiful picture of mentoring.
Yeah.
Moses could have just said, aha, and not mentored someone.
He mentored Joshua. Yes, he did. And he matured. I think that's, if any of you are leaders or just in anyone's relationship with God, you know, it took him a while, but he finally stepped into what God actually called him way back in the beginning to do. Doesn't mean he does it perfectly from now on, but you do see him here kind of rising up to be what he's supposed to do. So Shabbat Shalom, and downstairs the worship service is starting. If you can, if you can stay there,
take their chair,
put it against the wall.
Down from the beginning.